The Guardian. Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's Friday, August the 8th. I'm Claire Catford. On today's podcast, former miners' union leader Arthur Scargill tells us why clean coal is the answer to the UK's energy crisis.
We ought to be using new technology such as carbon capture, such as fluidized bed combustion and combined heat and power.
Drugs and artificial insemination make little difference to infertility, says a new report. Science correspondent Ian Sample's been investigating the findings.
Although it's actually unpopular to tell couples that we're not going to give you treatment, we're going to send you home and just tell you to get on with it and maybe give you some advice on when to get on with it, it seems the sensible thing to do.
And Knives, Guns and Bombs, the play set originally in Brixton, changes location to a Sarajevo classroom. It comes to Edinburgh later this month.
I mean, we understood that the play works perfectly for Bosnia today.
But first, a summary of the day's main news and a review of the papers with Sandy Waugh.
The 29th Olympic Games begin today in Beijing. The opening ceremony is expected to attract 3 billion TV viewers around the world. More than 80 heads of state will join 91,000 spectators and 15,000 performers. 35,000 fireworks will illuminate the five-hour show. Despite concerns over pollution, security and human rights, organisers are promising a 16-day extravaganza of sport. We'll be hearing from our team in China in just a moment. Britain has experienced the biggest annual fall in house prices since 1983. Halifax, the UK's biggest mortgage lender, has revealed the year-long credit crunch has wiped £20,000 off the cost of a home. The announcement came as rising inflation forced the Bank of England to leave interest rates unchanged at 5%. And fresh evidence of the global financial turmoil will emerge today when the Royal Bank of Scotland is expected to unveil losses of £1.2 billion, the biggest in British banking history. More on this later in Guardian Daily. Pakistan's president's facing the prospect of being thrown out of office. It's after the country's fragile coalition government announced plans to impeach Pervez Musharraf. The move plunges nuclear-armed Pakistan into fresh political turmoil as it grapples to cope with a biting economic downturn as well as a security crisis. Musharraf's cancelled his trip to the Olympics and is believed to have told supporters he will fight the impeachment proceedings. Russia claims Georgia is preparing for war against South Ossetia, the capital of the breakaway region. Came under heavy fire last night, just hours after the Georgian president denied Russian accusations he was planning military action. Casualty figures are unclear, but the escalating violence has raised fears of an all-out regional conflict. It could draw in Russia, which has close ties with South Ossetia's separatist leadership. The Tories are claiming the education gap has widened under the Labour government. A report by the Conservatives entitled A Failed Generation says the chance of an English schoolchild getting good results is dictated by where they live. But Schools Minister Jim Knights dismissed the claims as selective, saying Labour's analysis of the achievement gap shows it's narrowed since 1997. The morning's papers now. Striking pictures of the Olympics are printed on the broadsheet's front pages. Will China see the light, asks The Independent, across a photo of fireworks exploding from the Bird's Nest Stadium in front of a stiff-looking official. The Guardian has an image of the five Olympic rings created by hundreds of well-behaved, bikini-clad women standing in a swimming pool. One of the writers in the Mail says he's dumbstruck at how athletes can devote years of their lives to the pursuit of glorious silliness. The last lap for the Olympic flame, says The Telegraph, as it pictures the torchbearer on the Great Wall of China. A similar picture in the Times, but from the opposite direction, showing thousands of volunteers dressed in yellow disappearing into the distance and into the smog. The paper also reports on how crime lords in Britain are running a £40 billion underworld being masterminded from inside jail. The Sun prints further details of sightings of Madeleine McCann, this time three in Belgium. On a similar theme, a world exclusive from The Mirror as it pictures the drawings of two suspects in the case cited in the Netherlands. I saw her on a tram, says The Express, as it goes through more case documents released by Portuguese police. The back page of The Mail says Kevin Peterson's big gambles paid off with Steve Harmison on fire again on the first day of the final test at the Oval. There's more on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
Paul Kelso in Beijing.
There's going to be an enormous amount of marching and an even larger amount of fireworks, I think. We've got 15,000 performers will be in involved in the show, which is expected to last about 3 hours. With 91,000 people inside the stadium, that's a pretty high ratio of performers to audience. They've kept most of it under wraps. The promise is that this will be a reflection of Chinese cultural history, and certainly I think they will be looking to steer clear of any overt references to China's modern history. I don't think we'll expect to see Mao or any reference to Taiwan or Tibet in this. There are actually 5,000 members of the military involved as performers. But again, I would be surprised if they were to appear in uniform. Anything that evokes a sense of the military parades that we used to watching on the television from May Day here, anything that has a sense of the Chinese might, I think will be unwelcome. I think this will be every chance this will be absolutely artistically splendid. I mean, opening ceremonies are, as a rule, quasi comical events. We have nations desperate to express themselves and show the best of the world, but they're inevitably over choreographed and pretty humorous. This one, I think, will be different. I think we'll see. There's a chance we'll see more gymnasts balancing on fewer gymnasts than we've ever seen before. The fireworks will be spectacular if the practice runs we've seen, the rehearsals we've seen, or anything to go by. They've been enormous. And then we get the joys of the athletes' parade, which is all 205 nations troop out, and we get to savage the British team for their dreadful choice of casual wear, as well as enjoying some of the other things we can predict, like the fact that the Bermudan team will be in shorts and the one from Panama will all be wearing hats. So it'll be the sublime and the ridiculous will never be more apparent perhaps than tonight. After all the anticipation, the talk and the pollution, the politics, we finally get some sport starting tomorrow, and it'll be a relief to see some athletes actually appearing. That's when games always come to life. These buildings and these vast construction projects and everything else only make any sense when you see people who've spent the last 4 years training and working as hard as they can for the possibility of winning a medal. For Britain, it's going to be, if our predictions and the optimism is justified, it's going to be the most successful game since non-boycotted game since 1920. They're looking at winning 35 medals plus to finish at least eighth in the medal table, and I think there's every chance they could do that. Sport's unpredictable. We shouldn't take anything for granted, but without doubt the most expectation sits on our track cycling team, who are simply the very best in the world at what they do. They could win as many as 7 gold medals and 12 medals in total. That may be hoping for too much. That requires everyone to perform to their very best form. But you get surprises. They may win more, they may win fewer. We'll see medals, we hope, in sailing and in rowing and in the equestrian events. The Australians, rather brilliantly a few years ago, said that you can count on Britain to win in the events that you do sitting down, and that this one's going to be no different. So lots to look forward to. For full coverage of the Beijing Olympics over the next 2 weeks, go to guardian.co.uk/Olympics.
End nuclear power electricity generation now and invest in mining Britain's vast coal reserves. An integrated energy policy based on clean coal technology is the only way to meet the energy needs in the UK. So says Socialist Labour Party leader and former NUM President Arthur Scargill in a response to an article earlier this week by author and environmentalist George Monbiot. Monbiot believes that runaway climate change can only be arrested if we stop using coal. Here's Mr. Scargill's response.
I disagree completely, particularly when we take into account the fact that of the total emissions of CO2 into the atmosphere in the UK, over 80% are produced from oil and from gas.
He says, though, Monbiot claims, that if we had coal-fired power stations, we would have 54 million tonnes of carbon emissions per year.
Well, what he's doing, of course, is simply saying that if we have power stations which continue to generate electricity using either outdated methods or imported fuels as we are at the present time. He's not taking into account, for some reason, inexplicably in my view, that we ought to be using new technology such as carbon capture, such as fluidized bed combustion and combined heat and power, all of which would reduce the CO2 emissions, in my view, to zero.
He does address the carbon capture and storage possible facility, and he says that it would almost make it impossible to make it mandatory that existing and new coal-fired power stations would have that technology. At the minute, they're not obliged to have it, and they wouldn't have to sign the dotted line.
Well, of course, if people are not made to do things, then they won't do them. But there's no reason on earth why governments all over the world, and in particular in this country, cannot do what they said they would do, and that is meet the decision of the Kyoto Agreement to reduce the amount of CO2 into the atmosphere. In order to do that, it means it must be mandatory that all existing coal-fired power stations, oil-fired stations, and gas-fired stations, all which produce CO2, should have fitted carbon capture and should be having fitted all the technology that we know does exist, and in that way we would not merely reduce it, we would practically eliminate it.
You make the point that the government therefore has to enforce these mandatory rules. However, do we have at the current time a government who could do that? Monbiot's criticism is that Brown, Straw, Darling, Hutton, Bliers, Kelly and Hoon simply don't have any teeth.
Well, I don't think either this government or the previous government had any determination to do anything about it. Don't forget, these are the people who crucify the coal mining industry, and one would have expected, having closed 192 pits, dismissed 170,000 miners, closed down something like 60% of coal-fired generation, or made it non-operational, there would have been a reduction in CO2 emissions. And in fact, there's been an increase.
But is it the case, sorry to interrupt you, but is it not the case that any government has this very symbiotic relationship with business? And in effect, if the businesses don't want to sign on the dotted line, they won't, and government is frightened of alienating that business.
Well, there's a simple answer to that. Take all the generating companies back into public ownership where they should belong. Take back in all the generating fuels back into public ownership and control and make it mandatory. There is no reason why the plan for coal, which was signed in 1974, should not be reinstated. But alongside that, there should be a plan for energy consumption. And that means that the market for coal, and I'm talking about the market in terms of power generation or industry or domestic, also should have its part to play, and that can only be done by a decision of government telling those industries which they own on behalf of the British people what they must do.
But which government is going to bring back clause for that commitment to public ownership, frankly, in this day and age?
Well, in this day and age, the political party I lead, the Socialist Labour Party, there's none of the others are interested in socialism or even in nationalisation. And don't forget, there's a fundamental difference in nationalisation and common ownership. Even the Americans have got more nationalisation than we have, but there can be no doubt that if you want fundamental change and a climate reduction eventually leading to the total elimination of all CO2 emissions, then you've got to do that by government diktat and not leave it to the market forces of multinational corporations who are acting in terms of globalisation and their shareholders.
Now, you've challenged George Monbiot to a test. You say that you're prepared to go into a room full of CO2 for 2 minutes. If he's prepared to go into a room full of radiation for 2 minutes, what's wrong with nuclear?
What's wrong with nuclear is that it's absolutely deadly. It's caused the death so far of over 100,000, or will have, within a 30-year time span from the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. And I know that because I was on the TUC commission that investigated the Chernobyl disaster. I also was the advocate at the Sizewell public inquiry and the Hinkley Point public inquiry. And I know the danger and how deadly low level as well as high level radiation is. And I tell you this, there's no question that radiation in and around a nuclear station does result in a 10% increase in leukemia and cancer, particularly amongst children.
And you can read more of Arthur Scargill's thoughts at www.guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. Elsewhere on The Guardian's website today, England's bowlers finally had a good day in the cricket. Follow all the action from the Oval in the final test match against South Africa at guardian.co.uk/cricket. Our theatre critic, Michael Billington, remembers playwright Simon Gray, who's died at the age of 71. That's at guardian.co.uk/culture.
and latest news and views from protesters at the King's North Climate Camp in Kent. All that at guardian.co.uk/environment. The outlook for the UK economy is looking gloomier, with business confidence fast evaporating and house prices falling faster than at any time since 1983. In addition, the banks are facing big financial challenges. I asked The Guardian's economic editor, Larry Elliott, for his reaction to the news that Barclays has had to write off another £1 billion due to the credit crunch.
All the British banks have been reporting over the last week, and the figures have been uniformly poor. And Barclays, like all the others, has been very badly affected by the credit crunch. It was exposed to the subprime mortgage market in the US. It made some bad investments, as it now transpires, and it's quite heavily exposed to the property market in the UK. So profits this time were 2.75 billion as opposed to 4.1 billion last time, with lots of write-offs. So, you know, very disappointing, as their chief executive admitted.
It's all looking increasingly gloomy. We've got manufacturers complaining and saying that things are bad news there. Also, house prices are falling faster now than at any time since 1983.
Yeah, that was the figure from the Halifax. Halifax has been bringing out monthly house price figures since the early 1980s, and we've had some pretty bad times in the housing market during that period, particularly at the end of the 1980s and the start of the 1990s. But over the year to July, prices were about 11% down on the same time last year. That's taken £20,000 or more off the average price of a home. And that's a rate of decline we haven't seen in that entire 25-year period. So that's quite a chunky fall, and more to come, I fear.
And many people, of course, me included, remembering the negative equity scenario in the early 90s. We're likely to see more and more of that, aren't we?
That's right. At the moment, not that many people are in negative equity, because prices did go up quite sharply in the 3 years up until 2007. The Halifax say the gains of the last 2 years have now been wiped out, so we're back to where we were in 2006. So if you bought a house any time between 2006 and 2007, you're probably already in negative equity or on the brink of it. Further falls will obviously bring people in who bought homes before that. And there was a set of figures out this week which suggested that if prices fell by something like 25% or thereabouts, 20-25%, we could see 1.7 million people in negative equity by the end of next year, which would be the same number who in it as in the early 1990s. So quite serious stuff, actually.
And elsewhere, there's confusion about the solution. The Monetary Policy Committee say they're pulled in opposing directions. You've got rising inflation and slowing growth. So a rise in interest rates, of course, would be completely inappropriate, wouldn't it?
Well, there are some people on the Bank of England Monetary Policy Committee think that they should raise rates. Well, there were some last month. We haven't yet seen the full details of who voted for what this time. But there are some who think that inflation is already running at 3.8%, which is nearly double the government's target. It's going to go higher over the coming months as we get higher energy bills feeding through into the inflation figures. And there are some who think that the bank's job is to keep inflation low, and if it doesn't do that, it will be falling down on the job. So there are people who think that it should send out a sort of shot across everybody's bows to say, look, we're the Bank of England, we have a target, we intend to hit it. The thing is, though, that at the moment, the economy is so weak that a further increase in interest rates would be such a blow to consumer confidence and be such a sort of devastating blow to the housing market and to the retailing sector and consumers spending more generally, that it would really be deepening and lengthening what will already be quite a tough period and probably a recession. So the bank, if it were to go down that route, would be running the risk that it would be making a recession, an even deeper recession, necessary.
And finally, you say the government's got its hands tied because the election, of course, is only 2 years away.
Yeah, I mean, this is a particularly bad time for all this to be happening for a government which is as unpopular as this one. I mean, it's in these circumstances, what the government would dearly like would be for the Bank of England to be cutting interest rates now, and for there to be some sort of hope for homeowners that mortgage rates are going to come down and the house prices will stabilise and start to go up. There really is no real sign of that happening anytime soon. So the government is now being forced to take its own measures, really. It's thinking about its own measures because the Bank of England has its hands tied. The Treasury is now thinking up ways of boosting the economy. That could be through a cutting stamp duty, or it could be some help for people with their gas and electricity bills. But the problem for the government is that it's already running a deficit of something like £40 billion a year. Slower growth means that that deficit will increase in any event, because tax revenues go down in a recession and public spending on unemployment benefit and other benefits goes up. So the government's really running on empty when it comes to scope to deal with this. And it will, in order to actually boost the economy, it'll have to get even deeper into debt. So that's something that will constrain them. I mean, they won't be able to come up with an unlimited package of goodies for voters because they simply haven't got the cash.
Larry Elliott on the challenges facing the UK economy. I'm Claire Catford. Still to come in today's Guardian Daily, Sarajevo on stage in Edinburgh, a new play that shows the brutal reality of youth violence in Bosnia.
My role, Iron. He's very nervous and very dangerous young man because of situation is in his family. His mother is alcoholic.
And protests in Bolivia as tensions between pale-skinned elites and the indigenous population reach breaking point. But first, the two most popular fertility treatments, a fertility drug and artificial insemination, don't work, according to a new report. The British Medical Journal report says that these treatments are a leap of faith and that couples who are facing infertility should stay with natural methods. I asked The Guardian's science correspondent, Ian Sample, whether infertile couples have been wasting their time and money.
What this study is doing is it's looking at those 30% of couples who have problems conceiving, who go to fertility clinics, and after all the tests, doctors can't find anything wrong with them. So obviously there are a million and one things that can cause fertility problems. But for those patients that don't have anything absolutely findably wrong, they're basically diagnosed with what's called unexplained infertility. Now, for those patients, what you tend to do is clinics will almost always initially give them a drug called Clomiphene or Clomid, and the second stage of treatment is IUI, which is intrauterine insemination. Now, what this study suggests is that those two frontline defences really don't have any beneficial effect on the number of live births you get than if you just sent the couples home and said, get on with it.
There's a lot of money at stake, of course, with all of this. And also, emotions run incredibly high. I mean, relationships have been known to split up over infertility. Do you think this survey is going to contribute to people getting the right kind of help?
I do. And the clinic that's done this in Aberdeen is already changing its procedures. It's calling on NICE, you know, the which governs advice for treatments like this, calling on them to change their guidelines. What they're saying is that although it's actually unpopular to tell couples that we're not going to give you treatment, we're going to send you home and just tell you to get on with it and maybe give you some advice on when to get on with it, it seems the sensible thing to do because these drugs have side effects. It will give women hot flushes. It will give them bloating and things like that in some cases. Obviously, IUI has, you know, isn't a particularly pleasant procedure. So these guys are saying, look, it's more fun and cost effective and less traumatic to just face the facts of what the evidence says and send the couples home.
One of the things, of course, that we're all susceptible to is if we're told that something can't work, we try every which way to try and make it work. And also there'll be those in the medical profession who'll say, actually, this is not correct, this survey, particularly those who probably have a vested business interest.
There will undoubtedly, and this is one study to come out. And what is interesting about this study is it's the first one to compare a drug against doing nothing or treatment against doing nothing, whereas before people always compared drug against drug, treatment against treatment. So this is actually saying, yeah, well, are these any of these actually better than just having sex? And they're not. And, you know, people can, I think fertility clinics will actually probably interpret this depending on how strongly the patients call for it. If a patient comes in and absolutely demands to have Clomid or absolutely demands to have artificial insemination, IUI, I suspect that may still happen, but it's more, you know, the evidence suggests that it's not worth them having it.
And finally, the pressure to try any kind of possibility, it really is on. If you go into one of these fertility clinics, you've got pictures of the babies that were conceived all over the walls. This is such an emotional area, isn't it?
It is. But what these guys are saying is, look, this is a lot of money we are putting into these treatments, and they are dished out very quickly to almost all of these people who don't have an obvious, you know, sort of diagnosable fertility problem. So why don't you just take that money and use it to fund more IVF cycles, which the NHS isn't particularly good at doing in this country? That is more effective, according to a lot of doctors. So that would actually help these couples in the long run.
The Guardian's science correspondent, Ian Sample. Tension is rising in Bolivia in the run-up to a referendum on President Evo Morales' rule on Sunday.
Morales is the country's first indigenous president and was elected in 2005. Indigenous people make up around two-thirds of the population. Ask The Guardian's Latin American correspondent Rory Carroll what the president's opponents were protesting about.
They're protesting about what they say is a very autocratic and polarizing form of rule. They accuse Evo Morales of favoring the indigenous majority and basically overriding the rights and privileges of the paler-skinned minorities that for generations had been top dog in Bolivia.
He is the first indigenous president, and he won that decisive victory in 2005. There are those, though, who say that his nationalisation and land redistribution programmes haven't gone far enough. They're his key policies, aren't they?
Yes, that's right. Some of his loyalists are actually impatient with the pace of change. They say that despite his apparently radical agenda, Evo Morales really has yet to deliver on the huge expectations that he brought. He said that he would roll back 500 years of oppression going back to the time of the conquistadores. And there's a lot of truth in that. Despite big talk of land reform and shunting, redistributing resources to the poor majority who are mostly confined to the Western Highlands, on the ground is still a lot to be done.
What about the context and the long-running tensions over control of the huge reserves that Bolivia has of natural gas?
Yes, well, that's complicating and compounding the divisions between Evo Morales and the opposition, who are based largely in the relatively prosperous eastern lowlands, which also happen to be where the deposits of oil and gas are. And Evo Morales is fighting for the central government to get the lion's share and to control all of these things, whereas the provinces, who are often controlled by opposition figures, are doing their damnedest to hold on to these revenues for themselves. So this is also driving this deep and dangerous polarization that we're seeing in Bolivia.
Does Morales think there is some kind of conspiracy theory? Because he's blaming the protests on the US, isn't he?
Yes, this is a standard line from Evo Morales, which he's repeated from his big ally, Venezuela's president, Hugo Chavez. So he frames this conflict but in terms of that his opposition, who are kind of paler-skinned and richer, are in fact almost stooges of Washington, and that they are reflecting the interests of the United States. Now, I think this plays well with his own hardcore supporters, but I think generally in Bolivia people realize that this is very much an internal affair.
And, of course, this is a country where there is that huge gap between rich and poor. Is this protest, this conflict about those divisions primarily, or has ethnicity got more to do with it?
Well, it's all tangled together, really. I think what we're seeing, Evo Morales' supporters will say that racism is very much at the heart of it, and they say that that is why the opposition are now determined to try to block Evo Morales, despite the fact that he's a democratic mandate. Whereas the opposition say not at all, that this is really it's just about respecting their own interests and respecting plurality of interests in what is a very complicated country. So what we're going to see now on Sunday, when there's this recall vote, will be an attempt by Evo Morales to reclaim the political initiative, because his radical project to refound Bolivia, as he would put it, has basically faltered in the teeth of this fierce opposition. So what he's hoping is that if he wins a fresh mandate in this referendum, that he can then regain the initiative and try to put his project back on track.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
I'll give you such a kicking, your mother will have to scrape you off the floor, the spatula. Words straight from the mouth of a Sarajevan schoolgirl. This kind of language features in Class Enemy, a new play that comes to Edinburgh later this month, based originally on the experience of youth violence in South London. In a bold new adaptation, it premiered in Sarajevo last year. It shocked its audience as well. The Guardian's Kate Connolly has been to see it. Sve ja ljubim što me kruži, sve mi pjesmi daje temu, sve me skupa ropski služi, a ja opet rob sam svemu. This is downtown Sarajevo, a bustling city which has experienced much strife in its time, including 4 years in which it was under siege during the Bosnia War in the 1990s. On one of the former front lines of that war, a tree-lined alley in the district of Grbavica,
sits the bombed-out engineering faculty of Sarajevo University. Cables and debris dangle from the roof, and it is a crumbling wreck. Yet here inside, a vibrant piece of theatre is being created. A group of young actors from the independent East-West Theatre Company are putting the final touches to a bold production that they plan to bring to the Edinburgh Festival later this month. This is no play for the faint-hearted. It is a reworking of Class Enemy, a play by British writer Nigel Williams, which when it premiered at the Royal Court in London in 1978, created a huge debate about how much society was to blame for juvenile crime. This Bosnian version transports the action to modern-day Sarajevo, where violence in the classroom has become a big problem. The play is set in a dilapidated classroom where foul-mouthed students wait for teachers who never arrive. They barricade themselves against the outside world using desks and chairs. They conduct their own lessons, which grow ever more brutal and end in tragedy. In a break from rehearsing, I spoke to the 26-year-old lead actor who told me how effectively the play reflects social problems in post-war Bosnia.
My name is Zamar Selimović. I was born in Tuzla, I'm 26, and I'm living in Sarajevo for 8 years. My role called Iron, he's very nervous and very dangerous young man because of situation is in his family. His mother is alcoholic, his father was killed during the war. And because of the society here in Bosnia-Herzegovina, nobody doesn't care for him and his colleagues in classroom because of school.
All the cast members come from a generation which lived through the war as children. All the players, from across the national spectrum, including two rappers from northeastern Bosnia, have their own horror stories to tell. Haris Pasovic is the director of Class Enemy. He made the courageous decision to take Williams' play, set in 1970s Brixton, and thrust it into contemporary Sarajevo. As he told me, he was prompted to put on the play by the growing number of reports on juvenile violence in the media.
I noticed that more and more articles refer to the youth crime committed in the schools, around the schools, that involved knife crime and sometimes guns or some false bomb alarms and so on. I mean, we understood that the play works perfectly for Bosnia today.
The play has forced the issue of youth violence to the fore in Bosnia, creating a debate on the streets and in the media. Now, as the cast prepares to bring their searing production to the Edinburgh International Festival, critics have put it high on the must-see list. For the fledgling East-West Theatre Company, being invited to Edinburgh marks a milestone in their careers, as well as the world of theatre in Bosnia-Herzegovina. It is a good reason for optimism amid so much gloom.
Kate Connolly on the challenging new play that comes to Edinburgh later in the month. That's it for today's edition of Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's will be available to download from 7:30 in the morning. Producing today, Phil Maynard and Andy Duckworth. I'm Claire Catford. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.